Welcome to Season 3 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istril and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today, we're going to have a quick intro, including some spoilers. And if you want to read about them, you could check it in the comments. We're going to have the Beyond the Wall lessons learned from recent tournaments. We're going to have an interview with a fantastic artist, and I'm going to pronounce her name wrong, so Alex is going to jump in.
Magadi Vinev.
And then we're going to have some closing comments.
This is episode 15, and it is a month after episode 14. I hang my head in shame.
I blame Sean. He's the new guy.
Oh, wow. I knew this was coming. To be fair, I not only did my computer break, but it was crunch at work, pushing the product out the door. A little bit of a unstable ground to be all of a sudden, hey, go and edit everything.
Well, he's the new guy. It's his fault.
I don't know. I think we're all equally responsible, and it's terrible and shameful. And
it's true.
Really. But we've managed to make this work in the past with our travel and our other things, and here we cut down to once every 2 weeks. Missing one isn't really excusable, and I apologize to our listeners for that. We all had very good reasons individually, but this is just a lack of proper planning and lack of proper setup. So I'm sorry. With that out of the way, though, we do have a fair bit of news, and we recorded episodes, and we just didn't get a chance to edit them, so we have some old news, too. But we didn't have John on for that last recording, so John, why don't you tell us which side you're going to support, the Battle of the Trident, the FFG sort of L5R-like event where you get to support and sort of decide which agenda gets released in the future.
Can I have more information on that?
You don't actually know what this is?
No.
Jeez. Wow. See, now John hasn't been in touch for months. I didn't even remember what his voice sounded like anymore. The Battle of the Trident is an event that FFG is running alongside Worlds, and the gear for it is shipping out in the store championship kits, where there'll be Twitter results and tournament results that factor into choosing whether a Knights of the Realm agenda, a Call to Arms, which is an army agenda, or a Conclave, which is a Maester's agenda, will get printed later on in the game. So it's the results of the tournaments and the players who place higher will be weighted higher, and there'll be some other ways to interact with it. We'll get to decide this. And we don't know what the agendas will look like text-wise. We don't know anything about that. We just know which direction they're going to push.
Very cool.
So there is a right answer, and Sean and I have already agreed. What is the correct answer as to which side you're supposed to support?
So I'm supposed to support either the armies, the maesters, or the knights, right?
Yeah.
Those are your only options, yes.
I'm going to go maesters.
A good man. Nice. All right. I'm glad. I'm glad we're all agreed. Excellent.
I answered right. Well, something wrong here. It must be the mountain's influence. He's always right.
Oh, dear. I thought we could at least avoid that. What else have we had? Well, just this week, we've had the announcement of the Lannister box. I think, John, you have some things to say about that.
I do. I read a bunch of the comments and stuff, and people were like a little bit upset about the Lannister box release, and Lannister being one of the, probably the strongest house right now, or close to it. One of the top for sure. Very powerful faction. But I didn't see any cards where I went, oh my God, Lannister's going to get more powerful. What I saw was, oh my God, Lannister's going to get more diverse. And that's a good thing, I think. It really looked like they were pushing other themes more than empowering the current Lannister from the cards I saw. You know, you can see that in Cersei. You can see that in Tyrion. So I think people are overreacting a little bit about the power level. What about you guys think?
That's basically what I had as well. I mean, I see that Tyrion, and he doesn't look like an upgrade to the 5 cost, but he looks like someone I can build a deck around. The Cersei is the same thing. It's a great card, but it requires me to build an intrigue deck, which is not what I'm currently playing out of Lannister.
No, you're building a smashy mill deck.
That's
no,
right.
Lannister has the mountain. He kills stuff.
I've been told.
With the Cersei, I'm seeing kind of a return of an old archetype for Lannister, the no-kneel power behind the throne deck. You know, you've got Cersei now, you've got Jaime. all they need is some sort of power rushy agenda off of doing challenges, and that deck comes back.
They already have it all in location form, right? Small Council Chambers, Ghastly Rock, and Lannisport.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's a lot of tempo to get that going, though.
I remember in first edition yelling about how I didn't really think Power Behind the Throne was a very good design for an agenda because of the mirror matches and things, and I thought it was lazy and it could be done with cards instead. I guess that's what they did, right? They've got Power Behind the Throne built into all these other cards, so you can build that intrigue deck.
Yep,
that's true.
It seems, you know, Tower of the Hand will be a big help there.
In that deck, yeah.
Yeah.
But I also, I like what we've seen. So they listed a whole bunch of characters that we're going to be seeing for the other factions, and they showed us a Last Hearth Scouts, which is sort of an anti-ambush card, and a Barristan Selmy, which is sort of an anti-getting your hand stripped card. But who else was that?
Basically, it looks like they're feeding the other factions cards that'll work good against Lannister. And they kind of did that a little bit with the Stark box. I think it looks like they're doing that again with the Lannister box, and that's a good thing. Cards that hurt Lannister would help the meta right now, especially if Lannister doesn't gain a lot of extra power from this box.
Yep.
I do have a question for FFG. Why do they hate Greyjoy so much? Why do they never spoil Greyjoy stuff in these deluxe boxes or these articles? If you look at the spoiler lists, like most of the articles that come out don't have anything with Greyjoy. This Lions of Castle the Rock, I don't think there's any Greyjoy cards that have been spoiled.
Well, we can remedy this, you know, Sean.
How's that?
We could spoil some Greyjoy cards.
Oh, you mean later on in the episode?
We could do it right now if you're feeling particularly down about all this Lannister.
Let's bust it out.
Oh, wow. Okay. This is news to me.
Well, this is we have two cards from the first draft pack, which... Honestly, when we were sent these, and we were going to air these in an episode 2 weeks ago, it really seems like FFG's fairly confident that there won't be much of a gap between cycles. So we have two Greyjoy cards from the first chapter pack. I don't know, Sean, yeah, you were the one complaining. Why don't you give us one of these cards?
Cool. Do I get to choose which one I get to spoil? I will spoil the good one. Pike, a unique location, 2 gold. It's an Iron Islands location. And it has an action, Neil Pike, to choose a character. Until the end of the phase, that character gains stealth. It's also loyal. So it's 2 gold. Make any character have stealth.
Any character is nice because it just means that those, you know, when you're bannering out, you can give all these other big, strong characters stealth.
You're thinking Miri, aren't you?
I'm thinking maybe Miri, maybe some Jaime Lannister. Anything that you can use in multiple challenges is sexy.
It is loyal, so you're not going to be able to combine it with some busted loyal cards of other houses, but it makes the main house Greyjoy more attractive, so I'm a fan.
It's a great card. But I'm also really glad that we've seen neutral ways to give any character stealth. In the Wildling Scout, for instance. And we've seen other in-faction ways to approach it, like the Old Bear Mormont's Bird, or Crow, or whatever. This is Greyjoy. Stealth is their strength. This is better than those. But I'm glad that we sort of have that. There's a neutral option. Any faction can use that. It's good. It's fine. And then there's a better version in-house. And I like that.
Me too.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
So the question here is, are we going to type up that card a little bit incorrectly? There's been a request from some listeners that we do that.
For the people who can't be bothered to listen?
Yep.
I've heard that request. That sounds like more work. You're dyslexic already, so why don't you just type it up normally, and then we can post that.
Perfect. I'll be in charge of writing up the spoiler, which is going to be, for everyone listening, not right.
All right, the other card is a 4-cost Greyjoy character. It's got a power icon. It's only strength 2. It's called Captain's Daughter. Really, really good art. It's an ally with the reaction, after a non-loyal character enters play, kneel your faction card and sacrifice Captain's Daughter to place that character on top of its owner's deck. So this is a card you have on the board, and your opponent sort of can't play certain cards, knowing that you're just going to put them on the top of their deck where they could subsequently get pillaged. It's similar to a card we had in first edition, which would kill the card and that card couldn't be saved. I do think that at 4 cost, with the faction kneel and the sacrifice, and the fact that it can't hit loyal cards, it's probably just a few too many conditions to ever see play. But these cards that your opponent has to try to bait you into using on the wrong card are really interesting. So I'll give them points for that.
Sorry, read it one more time. I was typing. I got Captain's Daughter 4 cost.
That's what I mean.
Just make it up. There's no reason why you need it.
It's a character, Tricon.
Go ahead. Yeah, sure. It's a Tricon now.
So one actual part about this card is it's a monocon power, which Greyjoy has way too much of. I think FFG has some sort of okay, I can't use the expression R-rated. They really love giving Greyjoy monocon.
No points for guessing what expression you were going to use.
And we don't need them. I mean, the house doesn't need any more power monocons. They need more icon spread. They need intrigue, most of all. I understand it's a house weakness, and you can't get them too much of it. But at the same time, they're not benefiting. You're not getting any board presence from this card unless your opponent plays something like Post Velar. If you can get them into a situation where you have saves and you can recover from an offensive Velar and then play this card before they get to go, this card is a bomb. But the problem is the card has to be on the board. You have to have the 4 gold, and you're sacrificing anything else you might be playing to play this, including your faction meal. And you have to sacrifice her. There's just so much wrong with this card.
So one other thing that we didn't get to talk about because it was in the previous episode was the fact that Gen Con was – tickets went up. They were sold. They vanished within – by the time the queue had cleared. And it was the only LCG to vanish even a week later. There were still seats for the other LCGs, not for Thrones. To my knowledge, they haven't added any further Thrones seats. But I mean, that's a huge thing. That Gen Con is, that Thrones is the only game that matters. But even bigger than that is that the week before that, Starlight went on sale. And this was with no prior hype. No people saying, hey, it's going to be up this weekend. Remember to queue, you know, like we did for Gen Con. And Starlight had 300 places, and they sold out basically in a day as well. So, wow. Thrones tournament scene, it's the LCG that matters.
Yep. And now in past years, they have bought, you know, 30, 40, or 50 extra spots to these tournaments, depending on the year, kind of near the end of June. So if I was a betting man, I'd say that FFG is probably looking at their space, you know, looking at what they could do, and they may be adding some additional spots, and people should kind of keep an eye out if those come up and grab them, because I know there's a bunch of players that actually have hotels and stuff, but they don't have tickets.
Sam Bratz is one of them, I believe. So I do know that Conquest is happening at the same time because the way they've divided it now is they have a day for the prelims, for the graduated cut, and then for the finals. They're all on different days. And Conquest is on the same time, same day, same time as the prelims for Game of Thrones. They're probably going to cut some away from Conquest, I think. It didn't sell as well.
Yeah, it's possible. And they usually have some demo table areas, and they sometimes say, okay, we're going to cut back on our demo for X, Y, or Z in order to get more space.
Let's hope so. I mean, it's a good problem to have.
Yeah.
You know, it shows that speed with which the Gen Con event last year sold out is not a fluke, that Thrones really is booming, and that it's the place to be.
And it was Mealy and Jost that sold out. And you guys, I know, Alex, you're not actually making it to Gen Con this year. It really saddens me. But, Sean, you're playing in both events, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm ready. Ready to sleep on your floor.
There is another big event that I also won't be attending because my son will be born about a month before, hopefully. And that's Worlds. So they just – initially last year they told us that they'd be giving information out in May. And
they just posted how to register this last week, right?
Yeah, and they didn't even tell – it had – it's like the day that registration will start, it will be opening at 8 a.m. And then there'll be another wave at noon, another wave at 8 p.m. And you're like, okay, that's great. What day? And that's not in the information. So I think they're a little bit behind on their Worlds planning. I'm glad that they at least got something out there, and Worlds is looking to be pretty exciting as well. It's also a little bit pricier, $75 base, $25 per additional event. But, you know, I think Worlds is, this year will still be fairly hectic because they're still doing all the Star Wars and all the non-Star Wars together. But I think this is sort of their transition into what should be a really nice setup for the subsequent years where they've got a little more room and a little more space to play with it and make it really interesting. So I don't get to use my saved World Championship ticket, unfortunately, this year, but they keep saving me spots for subsequent years, so hopefully next year I'll get a chance to see what they've done with it.
Woo-hoo.
I have one last point for the intro, and this is something that apparently came up in the Missouri tournament. It came up a little bit in the tournament I was in France.
The DQs?
The DQs for illegal decks. Now, as I understand it, the Missouri situation, I think 3 of the top 8 had too few banner cards. They had 11 banner cards. And in France, actually, the situation was a little bit different. One of the top eight, when they did the deck checks, had not entered his seventh plot there and was therefore forced to play with a blank plot. A blank plot has zero reserve, by the way, so it's a death sentence.
He hadn't entered, I mean, on his sheet?
On his sheet, yeah.
And they made him play with a blank.
And they made him play with a blank plot, yeah.
Wow. That's brutal. So, I'm sorry, I wouldn't have done that. I would have been like, is it the same? I would have talked to his people opponents. That played him.
Yeah, yeah, it
and
was
if they
the same.
All played the same plot, I would have just let him play with the plot. Like,
well, we've had this in the past. There was one case in Stalik when they did deck checks in Melee, and one person hadn't written, I think, which version of Asha they were using, and they were forced to flip it over and use a blank card, which was pretty painful as well. But I can understand where that's coming from, because, you know, you don't want to put too much burden where I have to judge whether this was intentional or not, or whether it was a problem or not. You just want to be able to say, look, I'm verifying the decks, and if it doesn't line up, then we have to do something. So I can definitely see that, and I think that it is a problem if you're playing your tournament with 11 banner cards, and if three of the top eight are doing it, people are not.
No. That's a big problem. That's an illegal deck. But what I'm saying, if the person had seven plots, they played seven plots the whole time, they forgot to write the seventh plot down on a piece of paper, that's where I draw the line. That's my line. You've just crossed my line. I would have let that person play the seven. I don't think they were trying to cheat. I don't think you were thinking they were trying to cheat. I would have let them play.
I don't think they were trying to cheat anyway. But, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, I think in Missouri it caused quite a few problems because they found this out, and then they tried to find people to fill out the cut and so on. But I really do think the players have a responsibility to play a legal deck to submit an accurate deck list.
I agree. They do. Sometimes errors happen. I mean, I always print my deck list because if I were to write my deck list, Alex, you can attest that it would be written incorrectly. And I would try my best to write it correctly, but it'd be written incorrectly. So I always print my deck list, so it's always accurate. But man, I'd be so mad if I got DQ'd because I had forgotten to write a seventh plot, or I had written, you know, for me, it would be worse if I wrote Asha and I wrote the wrong acronym next for the pack. Oh my God, I'd be so mad.
I'm a little bit curious to hear how you guys felt the Missouri situation, as far as you know it, because again, you guys weren't there firsthand, should be handled, and whether a disqualification is too harsh a punishment for what is probably a deck building mistake, or whether it's just, it is the correct action because the deck was illegal regardless of the intent.
Well, I think it was the correct action. The deck was legal, regardless of what you can do. I mean, you can have them swap cards on the fly, but is that really fair to everyone else who came to the tournament with a legal deck? It's a nightmare that I have recurring. I know I posted this on the Facebook group on the thread, that I'll come to a tournament and I'll have an illegal deck. Like, I've woken up in like cold sweats and like, you know, middle of the night, like, I just had a dream. I was at Worlds and Nate disqualified me. Like, that's really incredibly nerdy, but it's true that the onus is on you. You can't really complain, oh, you disqualified me because I fucked up. Well, actually, yes, that's exactly how it works.
Fair enough.
I do feel really badly for the people who went home after the tournament and might have been in 9th, 10th, 11th place and would have been bumped into the cut. Instead, what happened was they just found anyone that was around. And this was an hour later. This wasn't, you know, 10, 5 minutes later. This was people had left if they were already out of the cut. They were basically robbed of their position by this mistake and by the hour of calling Nate and FFG.
I mean, they had to check the decks. That takes time. I understand why it was 45 minutes later.
Yeah. I'm not saying the TO did anything wrong. They made the right decision in checking the decks and contacting Nate and finding the right way to do it. But I do feel a lot of sympathy for the people who were – this isn't a casual night. This is a premier league, right? This is a premier tiered event. This is serious business. People deserved a chance if they would have been bumped into top eight.
So, Alex, my answer is going to be a little bit more complex than everyone else's. Mine's actually really based on what Sean just said about the level of event. This was a regional. The correct move here was disqualification. I hate to say it, but there's no way to make that deck legal with the cards that are currently in it. You know, if they had four of a certain card, you could give them a loss and flip it. But, you know, a loss at the cut is basically a DQ anyways.
Correct.
So at the worst, at the best case scenario, they're taking a loss, which means they lose at top eight. But with an illegal deck that cannot be remedied, there's no wiggle room here. It's a DQ. If this was a store championship, I would most likely, as the judge, pick one of the cards that I thought was of significant power level in the deck. Tyrion, a Tywin, etc. I'd flip it over, call it their 12th.
Dark Garden.
Their 12th, yeah, fealty card, and say, there you go, you can play it like this. Because it's a casual event. And casual events were way more lenient. It's more likely we have new players, people that are just learning the rules. So a mistake like this would be higher, and we're supposed to actually react to those mistakes in a different way. So if I was a judge, I would react to it in a different way in these two types of events. In a casual way, I'd probably let the person still play on. And in the a regional where it's no longer a casual event, I would say, I'm sorry, you can't. If you were still learning or if you were rushing, then you should be playing in these other types of events.
I think there's another factor as well, which is that at a store championship, frequently the judge is playing, doesn't have time to do deck checks.
Yep.
And that's an important qualification. At the store championship I ran, I wound up checking the decks of the finalists the finalist after the tournament had been finished, just to ensure that there wasn't anything wonky. But he had played against me. I couldn't have DQ'd him.
Right.
So the store championship was different. But at a regional tournament, I think that there, hopefully, you have a little more time and you could start doing that process a little earlier on.
Yeah. So you actually would do the same thing as me, then you would allow it to go at a store champion, but anything up from that, you'd DQ.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Mm-hmm.
All right, it has been a long time, and we have all been to tournaments since we last recorded, so I thought we'd do a little, not necessarily tournament report, but maybe the kind of things that you've learned from these tournaments about either tournament play or the meta or your decks. Maybe starting with the first tournament that you guys attended. You guys both attended Rochester?
That's right.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I have to say that the store is a fantastic store. The owner is a great guy. And more importantly, he is a huge Game of Thrones fan. Like, he plays the game a lot. I know he travels for other regionals. This is Travis, yeah. And this really comes across in the store and how focused he had. He had a whole bunch of extra prize support. Just really well run, very well organized, great event. Can't say enough about Millennium Games.
Yeah, the focus on Thrones is pretty crazy. They had the broken token.
Yeah, they had Time Walker deck boxes, broken egg tokens, all in store for purchase.
Nice.
So if there was cool Thrones swag, these guys had it in store.
All right. Well, tell us a little bit about the tournament experience, what you went in expecting, what you saw, and what you learned from that tournament.
I built two decks. I built the Lani Dragon, and I built a Stark Fealty. And I was trying to decide whether I wanted to play competitively and take the Lani Dragon or play Stark and just for more of a good time, because the point of the Stark deck was actually to have every card that had the word Winterfell in the deck. Yeah.
Oh, God.
We were, and actually on the ride in, Sean was like, you missed one. I was like, what? And so we had to add a card. but I ended up going with the Winterfell deck.
I'm not surprised.
By the time we got there, I was completely tired to start. Like, we did a 5.5 hour drive to make it to the tournament, which means I woke up at 4:30 to get ready to leave here for 5 to pick up Sean and Adam for around 6. So it was, my wife says 5:30. Anyways.
Your wife is right. I mean, I wasn't there, but your wife is right.
We may need to do like a bonus segment as well, because we had a recorder in the car. So
yeah.
Here comes like I'm really hyped and I'm like, I'm going to take it all. And then at the end of the day, when I'm tired and dead and like disappointed, and how the contrast between the pregame and the postgame.
In fact, if other people edit this, I will edit the pregame segment tomorrow, the stuff from the store. But because we had about almost an hour of pregame stuff.
All right.
But what did I learn? Winterfell Castle in Stark is actually really good if your deck's built for it. I think it's way better than people give it credit for. And anyone that had tried it previous to the Stark box would probably think it's horrible. But with all these new low-cost, unique Stark characters, I think there's a lot of value. In fact, I think that people are building Stark decks in general a little bit weak to First Snow because they have these low-cost characters and they're just jamming them in. I think you're actually better to put the doubles and the triplicates of some of these unique ones in so that they can get the dupes to survive First Snow a little bit better. And I think that actually having Winterfell Castle really empowers them to win challenges, because one of Stark's biggest problems is they get behind and then they can't get their steam back. And I think that with Winterfell Castle, it allows them to, you know, force whatever challenge it is they want through. Because if you can get three uniques in it, you're getting an extra six strength, which can be a big swing.
I'm so skeptical, but all right.
It also makes Rickon a monster on a warden's turn.
Yeah, he can be a monster. He jumps in there and he's just like, bam, Rickon for an extra three strength or four strength. Winterfell itself is probably should be a three of in every Stark deck. That card was money all day as well. Being able to control when certain triggered effects will happen is a huge bonus. And that plus one strength is actually better than people think as well.
I lost a game because of that.
Yeah, that was kind of my takeaway from the Stark deck. But again, I wasn't playing a super competitive Stark deck. It could probably be better. A few people took pictures of some of the cards on the table because they were like, no one plays that stuff. but it was a good time. And we were really tired. I was playing very poorly all day. And I can't just blame that on tiredness. I just played poorly. So I apologize for anyone that had to play with me. I went 4-2. I tried to convince my final round opponent to take an ID so that I could go and get some food because I hadn't eaten since 6 in the morning or whatever it was. But I would make the cut if he would take it. But he couldn't make the cut whether he won or lost. So he decided to play it and then he beat me, and that's what knocked me out of the cut. How about your experience, Sean?
Well, one comment on that last bit before we go ahead. John was like, just to sort of fuel how deprived we were of sustenance, he was like uncharacteristically aggressive about the cut. I remember seeing him like standing up like wide-eyed, like you could see how tired he was, the big droops under his eyes. And he's like, no, you want it. You want an ID. Right now, IDing is a great idea. No, it helps you. It's the best thing you can do. And no, the guy just wouldn't have it. I mean, That really sucks. At that point, we really just wanted a chance to go and eat a sandwich. Speaking of which, we went and we got the biggest sandwiches you can imagine.
Oh my God, 18-inch subs. And I kid you not, I was so hungry when I took the first bite. My whole body like hummed and I felt so good inside. It was the weirdest feeling. It was like a drug. Because it had been like 12 hours and I'm not a small guy, Alex. I need my food.
there are so many horrible things I could say right now. But we're trying to keep this show not rated R, so I will avoid jokes about that 18-inch sum.
How good it was.
So Sean, what was your both Rochester and maybe your Hamilton takeaways?
Well, I can kind of amalgamate them because it was the exact same situation. So leaving Rochester, I said, never again am I going to drive 5 hours to a tournament and then 5 hours back, getting up at like 5 a.m. Lo and behold, a week later, I do the exact same thing for the Hamilton Regional. So really, I didn't learn my lesson the first time. This time, we got up earlier, and I went with Matt from the Ottawa Meta, and I played the same deck, and I got the same result, 4-2. And really, like, you can't underrate, like, a good amount of sleep and, like, a home field advantage. Like, you've had a good breakfast, you've got a lunch, you know. That stuff, I kind of, maybe from being like a young buck, I was like, I don't have to worry about it. I'll just eat like a bag of chips or something, you know, gas station food if they don't have anything nearby. There's bottles of water. I'm good, you know. But no, really coffee. I'm an addict now. So I played the Barrow Lion. It's pretty straightforward. Just a lot of Neil, a lot of control elements. But when you don't see what you need to see against a Tywin Rose Road reducer setup, you lose. And that's basically, in both tournaments, I played just an asinine amount of Alani, and I lost to, basically, when they put that setup out, that's when I lost. I did beat it once, I remember, with a double milk, except I think I staggered the milk until they played Confiscation. At any rate, that's basically the magical bullet for that.
Alex, you'd like to know about one of my losses. I think you'd really appreciate it. I opened with Pentoshi, and I got enabled.
Oh. I would, because I was actually going to say some of my takeaways. So I was at a tournament in Lille in France, the Régional du Grand Nord, which was well attended, 44 people. I had a great time. There was a supper planned between the Swiss rounds and the cut, and that almost everyone attended. Really, really nice store, too. We were up, or not really a store, it was a restaurant. We were up on the top floor. So really nice setup. Had a blast. I was convinced that I had to at least make top 16 to really piss Edge off, because they still hadn't mailed out the kits. And so everybody at the tournament's like, we got to make sure that they have to ship things out as far away as possible. So anyone who traveled the long distance has to win something. You know, at the very least, they're mailing you out your Altard Varus or whatever out to Canada just to teach him to mail the kits on time. But my lessons, I was playing a Greyjoy Dragon, some tweaks from the version that Sean had played previously, and I'd say Winterfell, as John was saying, is a 3x. In this meta, where a lot of people are playing Pentoshi to get their things like Miri out, Winterfell really allows you to solidify your board without expanding horizontally and being vulnerable to wildfire, or without investing in big characters that might not be protected and are vulnerable to things like Miri or Gregor. So I find that at least now with people playing those big high gold plots, Winterfell is a fantastic 3-of, and I'm delighted because I love that card. The other big lesson for me was naval superiority. I would say that about, what, maybe 8 or 9 people were running that, because a Night's Watch had won a tournament a week before, a regional in France, and had basically opened with it almost all the time. And the meta was starting to adapt to that and try and be kept honest, but it's really hard for those decks that rely on Pentoshi and Noble Cause, those Lani decks, anything with Banner of the Dragon. They typically have about 5 to 6 plots that are vulnerable to naval superiority, and I would go so far as to say that naval superiority might be compulsory in a fealty deck right now. Compulsory is too strong a word, but it is really, really good. So those would be probably the two take-home lessons that I'd have from that tournament. I made 8th in the Swiss, 4-2, losing to a Stark deck because I miscounted the Winterfell bonus. So John is right, that +1 strength really does matter. I goofed and Arya pulled off an ice against me, despite the fact that I should have had control over that match, and so I only made 4-2, and then I lost to what wound up being a top 16, but I was pretty pleased with that turn.
There's one thing I should mention, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this. Vinny from Rochester was at the Hamilton Regional with Travis, and we played basically for the cut, and he got the most ridiculously lucky. It basically made me quit the game for 2 weeks and just like reevaluate my life. He put out basically, okay, so first off, he put out Tywin, Rose Road, and a reducer on setup, which is pretty lucky, right? Then he put out Mountain, and with the Mountain's pillage trigger, he killed Melisandre off the top of the pillage, killing my Melisandre on the board. And just proceeded to clean up my board with every intrigue pull and every, you know, gamble effect. It was the most disgusting. What's that, John?
I was going to say, you think that's a good setup? I actually played someone, and I got someone to take a picture, and their setup was a reducer, a triplicated Tywin, and a gold road.
Oh, yeah, I was sitting next to you. That was gross.
So they set up 5 cards, but it was like really the 2 best characters you can get for setup, and then just dupes on them.
There's one thing that came out of that tournament that's maybe a little more controversial out of the tournament that I was at. First of all, no intentional draws. All the standings were very well. But one of the players who wound up doing quite well was playing very, very slowly, got a lot of mod wins. And there were some accusations that he was deliberately slow playing. So, for instance, there was a cut round where at the end of the hour, they had to continue playing a round they just started. They took about 45 minutes to play the next round, and I think there was a total of 5 power on the table.
What?
So it was a very slow game, and it was a Martell deck that was sort of focused on challenge denial and not losing those power challenges, and so it would frequently get to 4 or 5 power and then slow the game down. And whether that's wrong or not, I mean, you're gambling on mod wins taking you into the cut. And that may not have been what the player was doing. I didn't wind up playing against them or talking to them specifically, but certainly there were allegations of slow play there. And whether it's just because of all the complicated situations and that you're really trying to slow the game down, or whether it is you're actively taking more time than you should just because you have that advantage, I think it's something to watch out for. I think judges shouldn't be too scared of giving a warning for slow play early on in the tournament.
When I find someone's playing really, really slow, especially early on, like as the day progresses and you get more tired, I understand slower. Like I get slower. Everyone gets slower. But early in the tournament, I think if I ran into someone, I would probably call a judge just so they would know. Even if it's not their fault, they have to be cognizant. They still have to finish the games in that 55 minutes or an hour round. mm-hmm. much as possible. You know, you shouldn't be taking 40 minutes and then not doing any challenges. Be like, no, I pass actually.
It's hard when you're not sure if someone's a new player and they're just struggling to get the hang of it. But yeah, no, that sounds absolutely ridiculous that someone would place well in a tournament through mod wins.
That's tough. So what would you do if a player called you over and said someone was slow playing? Would you just watch the game at that point, Alex, for a little while and then say, yeah, that is a little bit too slow, and ask the person to speed it up? And then if it can't happen again, you give them a warning?
No, I would watch it there. And if it is slow, I would give them a warning. And then the next time I would DQ them if they get called on it again. I think it's something that you need to, I mean, it's, you sort of need to rely on what you're seeing. But you need to make sure that you made them aware that this is a problem, and that if someone else finds the same problem later on, you have to take some sort of action for the integrity of the tournament, I think.
Because sometimes people, like you said, there are times when you have to really do a lot of thinking before a challenge. So, you know, sometimes it's actually okay to take 3 minutes to plan a challenge. Other times you're like, no, you know, this should be 30 seconds. I'll say the judge has to make a lot of call based on the board state and what's in the person's hand. And like Sean said, if they're a new player or if it's the first time playing the deck, like there could be a lot in that. Mm-hmm. It's a tough call.
I remember at Worlds, I was playing someone and they told me they were going to slow play me because they didn't like my deck and they knew they were going to lose. And they sat there with two cards, one of them a refugee and the other one an event, I think. And they just shuffled them back and forth in the marshalling phase. I didn't call a TO over because I basically had the game, but it was really obnoxious.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing that calling a TO over and they can get a warning. It doesn't really matter if it's that late in the tournament, but it's still worth making the organizers aware of it.
Then there's the other side of the equation where I watched you play Sam Bratz at Worlds, Alex, for the top 8 or top 16 or something. Top 4 maybe? I don't know. Whatever it was.
Top 8.
Top 8, yeah. And I felt that he was playing very slowly, but I also felt that he wasn't slow playing you. He was going through the decision process, right? And taking his time to make sure he didn't make mistakes. And both of you were playing decks that had, you more so had a bunch of tricks in it where you could, you know, reduce strength or kill characters or jump things in. So the thought process takes a lot more time. So he legitimately was playing what I would consider slow. So it's tough sometimes to make the call, like what's, you know.
Even especially in that tournament, he was reading cards that I was using. You know, he was not as much of a Thrones player. I mean, he won that year. He's a phenomenal card player, but he was sort of entering the competitive field, having trained with the deck and
yep.
being a really good card player, but not being intimately familiar with the card pool. So
was that the Lannister Darkwings deck?
Yeah,
that was the Lanny Darkwings.
Yeah. I remember hearing interviews with him afterwards when he said he didn't even know what some of the cards did. And he would have to, he'd draw them and then he'd have to read them before playing. So he didn't even know all the cards in his own deck, let alone all the cards in the card pool. I'm not saying anything bad about him. He's obviously a great player. This is just another indicator of how good he is to be, you know, relying entirely on his interpretation on the fly.
Yeah.
Especially in first edition.
But because of that, I felt he was playing slowly, right? But I would say that that's one of the cases where as a judge, I would have to look at that, realize the background and say, no, he's not slow playing. He's just, that's the pace he has to go at if he wants to be able to make these decisions and read these cards and all that.
I do think it's interesting because I think that players in Thrones generally do play quite slowly. We take a lot of time on these decisions, and this has sort of become normal. I wonder whether it is possible to train the community to play faster. I mean, not individually train all the players, but whether you could start cutting time limits down to 45 and 40 and actually get games done that are faster where the decisions are quicker. I think it is possible. I think a Thrones match goes to time because players are taking a lot of time to weigh all these decisions, and that we could add the speed at which you can make those decisions to one of the skills that you're bringing to a tournament. I don't necessarily think the game would be better for it. I think it would make tournament organization easier, but I do feel that on average, we do play slowly.
Well, it's like chess, where you can go from regular chess to a speed chess where you're doing 30 seconds. It changes the skills that you need to play, right? It's more about pattern recognition, and more reps make a bigger difference.
It also depends on the deck you're playing. I think there's decks you can play within 30 minutes easily, and then there's decks like the Martell decks that require a lot more subtle manipulation.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's jump on to do the intro then.
Actually, I had one more thing to add. There was a controversy at the Hamilton Regional that you might be interested to hear about, Alex.
By all means.
So John Goble I think that's how you pronounce his name. He was the TO. I think it was his first time TOing. He was the only one there with about 40 people. So it was pretty, you know, it's a lot of pressure. And someone called him over. The situation, if I recall it, I'm probably incorrect a little bit here, but the gist of it was one player asked something informally like, are you done, or challenges. The other player made some sort of noise indicating they were good, but they thought it was acknowledgement that, of what they were saying. So the first player goes and he declares his challenge, and he kneels. I think it was Tyrion to do an intrigue or whatever, and he states what he's doing. And the other player goes, whoa, I had an action. So now the first player got a little irate because now he's revealed, he's tipped his hand what he's going to do. And the TO had to come over, and there was a whole breakdown in the tournament for like a little bit there. A lot of, I don't know, they even addressed it after the round and set the standard for what they would do in the future and how people should be careful about how they informally address the conclusions of action windows or beginning of round, things like that.
Each of those situations winds up being different, but really the easiest way to make sure that there's no ambiguity is to always ask for an explicit, you know, any action? None. Mm-hmm. And then you do it. And I mean, there was an episode of The White Book a while back sort of talking about this with Nate, and it's not long to ask that question. And if you remember to ask it regularly, you're not tipping your hand off either. If at the beginning of every challenge you go, action? No? All right. Challenge. And then you're not giving away that you have some special thing to do, and you can make it much fairer. But you sort of need to get explicit verbal mm-hmm. agreement from your opponent that they're passing.
I think that's a good sort of informal tip of the week. Always indicate whether your opponent has something to do or not. Ask them first before you take your actions.
Yeah, I mean, it can pay off sometimes. When I was playing Patrick in Dance, he had Illyrio on the board, and he had an Elt Tywin from My Filthy Accusations. And he marshaled first, and he passed to me. And I said, well, I think you made a mistake there, Patrick. You should stand your Tywin with Illyrio. And he said, no, in case you have Neil in your hand. I go, okay, that's a good call. You're right. So do you have any actions? He said, no. I said, great, my marshaling's over.
Yeah.
You know, and he was like, damn it. You know, and I was looking down at three events. So it can make a big difference. Getting that explicit agreement, I think you're right, Alex, is important.
Oh, especially for the closing of a phase. Like after a challenge, I always ask, action, no, pass, close, we're on to the next phase. I can cut someone off from doing something like ambushing an Olenna's informant or getting that stand in from Illyrio before the Stannis walk of, you know, that kind of thing. So I do think it can be very quick. It's an automatic question, and it's a good one to drill yourself to ask.
Yeah.
So we are joined here today by Magali Villeneuve. Magali, one of the iconic artists, genre-defining, not only for the Thrones card game, but for the Lord of the Rings card game, for the World of Ice and Fire. She's attended the European Championship at Castle Stalag. We've seen her art throughout the first edition. We've seen some of it in the second edition. Magali, thank you so much for joining us.
That's my pleasure.
So you're joining us late at night now, all the way from Paris? Is that where you live now?
Oh, no. I come from more in the south of France, near the ocean.
So we're talking Marseille, we're talking Nice,
We're talking Bordeaux. Where they are making wine and all.
One of the many places where they're making wine.
The main place, please.
The important place, yes. Yes. I got to tour Bordeaux when I was about 12. Unfortunately, I didn't much appreciate the wine at the time. I'm due for another visit.
Yeah, that's a lovely place.
So the first place that I wanted to start off is maybe to introduce yourself a little bit and tell us how you came to be working so closely with Fantasy Flight Games on so many different projects and so much of the art.
Well, it's been a long process, and the best way to explain it is to explain how I started as a pro. It was about 10 years ago now. I started very little, you know, in my country only. I was only working in France and mainly painting book covers at first, always in the, you know, fantasy style, but it was only book covers. So I worked like that for about 4 years. And in France, it's really not easy to make a living as an illustrator because, you know, fantasy and all is not a big thing in our country. And at some point, I realized that I had to make a change so my career would evolve a little. So one day I went to a library and I saw Fantasy Flight Games. They had published an art book about A Song of Ice and Fire, where you could see lots of their card game illustrations. And when I saw this book, that's how I discovered the company. And I thought, well, why not give it a try? So I sent my portfolio. And the first answer I received, I remember, was, you know, the typical answer that they sent saying, well, we don't have anything for you for the time being, but who knows in the future if something comes up and all. So I went just like, ah, okay, no problem. And 2 days later, I received another email, but a real one this time, asking me if I was willing to work on Game of Thrones. So I can tell you that this day was a very good day for me, because when I was dreaming about becoming an illustrator, I dreamed that I could maybe someday work for The Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones, well, A Song of Ice and Fire. And I never really believed it would come true. So when I received my first contract, it was for only two cards. It was Bastard Daughter. I don't know how to pronounce.
Bastard Daughter, yeah.
And His Viper's Eyes. And that was the very first ones. And I really believed it would be the last two ones in my whole career. I would never have imagined I would last for so long in the company. That's how it happened.
I didn't know that your start was actually in the Game of Thrones card game. I assumed that you had a lot of stuff before that and that you'd come into this, because His Viper Eyes is actually one of the few cards that they've reprinted and used that art, those haunting, that glaring out at you. So mm-hmm. it's still seeing play even now in the second edition much later.
Oh, really? Because I really don't know what... If they kept illustrations from the first edition, then, you know, placed them in the second, so I'm happy to know that there are
only the very, very good ones. So yeah, a couple of yours, obviously.
That's cool. I'm very happy about that.
I'm sure they have more coming as well. Everyone sort of has their own favorite artwork, and your name usually comes up in these discussions. So I wouldn't be surprised.
That's something. Yeah, that's something a little frustrating for me, because indeed I do receive a lot of emails asking me if I'm going to do some more art for the second edition. Turns out I really did not have enough time to be part of the, you know, the new wave of illustration. And that makes me sad, because I really can't say that if it weren't for my work on Game of Thrones and A Lord of the Rings at Fantasy Flight Games, my career wouldn't be what it is now. You know, and I received so much support from the players, and I still do, besides, that it always makes me sad that my current work doesn't allow me to work for Fantasy Flight Games as much as I did in the past.
Well, we may not see a lot of your work in Game of Thrones recently, but I think it was just about a month ago that we saw a new Eowyn, Lord of the Rings. And that one is a real chef d'oeuvre. I was blown away. It's fantastic. So I understand that practicality and wages and some of the work that you're doing sort of precludes you doing as much as you were doing for Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. But I'm so glad that we still get to see your work in Fantasy Flight Games projects, especially such stellar work.
Yeah, every now and then when there is... You know, because I am obviously a character painter more than anything else. I'm very good at painting humans, mostly. And when they have a very important character they think would look good, they give it to me. But painting Eowyn was really cool, because it was one in a very long time. So
Yeah, they only get you for the important characters. So I happen to have won a championship, which means that I get to design a card and get an artist to do a rendition of me on it, and they didn't think I was important enough for you to do them. They said, no, you don't deserve Magali. You deserve a six-year-old, so I'm sure I'll get a six-year-old to paint.
Yeah, it happened only once I could do the champions card. It was a French winner, I remember. It was a few years ago, but even at this moment, and at the moment the guy had his own card, I was still working full-time for FFG, but I was so busy even in this time that the guy had to, you know, really insist that, please, please, please. It was Grégoire Lefebvre.
Oh, Grégoire, yeah, that's right, yeah. With the Marjorie Tyrell.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, that's a beautiful card.
So you mentioned that you're very much a portrait artist, you know, mostly characters. You said only humans, but really lots and lots of elves as well.
Yeah.
But so how did that preference come about? Was that something you always had, or was it just something that you feel you're better at, more interested in? Where does that come from?
Yes, it's a bit of everything. You know, when you are an illustrator, I really do believe that you have to make a choice. Except if you're a genius, these things happen, but I am not a genius. You cannot do everything as well as, you know. So my real talent, I think, is painting humans. And it's my main interest, too. That's what I love to do. So each time I send a portfolio to another company, I always try to show them, look, I'm good at painting humans and all. So if you want to hire me, please let it be for that, because that's what I'm good at. So that's something, yeah, it's kind of my own choice. And in general, art directors know how to choose the right artist for the right thing. So in general, they will not hire me to paint dragons or creatures or, you know, environments, because that's not my thing. That's why I'm mainly painting important characters, which I'm very happy with, because I've been so lucky with what FFG made me paint.
I guess what FFG made you paint, that's a pretty good segue into something I'm very curious in, is what kind of constraints and guidelines do they give you when they say, okay, we want you to do an Eowyn? And, you know, what do they tell you about the card before you start working on it?
First of all, about the card in itself, we do not know what the card's ability is going to be. That's something we do not know, because it's not very useful for us. What we have to know is that whether it's going to be a creature or a hero or an ally or something like that, well, depending on the game, because it helps us knowing what will be the main focus. If it's a hero, obviously, you have to focus on the character. Nothing else matters as much. So you do not need to put a lot of action in it. You do not need to put a lot of background in it. The focus is the figure. And that's the most important information. After that, FFG, they choose the kind of atmosphere, you know, the mood of the card. So they tell us, you know, because, for example, let's take Eowyn's example. You have two versions of the same character. You have the lady one and you have the warrior one. Mm-hmm. So that's what they tell us. So please paint Eowyn in her armor and ready to fight with, you know. And it's only a few lines, in fact, telling us the mood and telling us what card it's going to be. We do not need any more information. As far as FFG is concerned, they tend to also give us a very, very short excerpt from the book, you know, something they think will be a good example of what the character is or what's the mood of it. It's very, we only have very simple information, because that's all that's needed.
You mentioned you need to know what kind of card it is, a hero, for instance. Does that change a lot based on, you know, the size of how things will look on the card, because there's different templates for for allies versus mm-hmm. heroes. Mm-hmm. There's different colors for each of the spheres or the factions mm-hmm. That might influence your color palette. Do all those other things come into play as well, or is the art sort of created independently from the card and then put on it?
The only other thing that matters is the template of the card. The color and all with FFG doesn't matter. The card has to fit in the frame, you know, of the final thing. That's all.
Interesting.
How much of your own research do you do? You mentioned that they give you an excerpt, but do you go and reread chapters, or what kind of research do you do on your own for a subject?
In general, I always have the book next to me, and I tend to, you know, to look for a few excerpts where the character or the scene is taking place. And there is also a wonderful tool. It's Google, and we can, you know, because you just look for this character, and you find all the biography, and it's wonderful. So if you forgot what the eye color is or the hair color is, or, you know, these details do matter. So it's very easy to find them thanks to internet.
Speaking of Google, how do you feel about your portraits becoming the standard for the book versions? I often see your artwork compared to the actors mm-hmm. or making the Wikipedia main art, you know, subject.
I am very happy about that because, well, on one hand, it's not always, you know, each time a new portrait is released, each time I'm showing something new on my Facebook page or something like that, and especially since the TV show exists, there's always someone telling me, you know, it looks too different from the TV show, or it's not like that. That's not how I imagine this character at all. So, that's okay. That's everyone has his own image of the characters. But I'm very happy that for quite a lot of people, my personal, because it's only my personal rendition of the characters, do seem to be accurate. And I'm very happy about that because that's really what I'm trying to do. Striving very hard to be as close to the text as possible. Yeah, that's something very important to me. Respecting the original book. That's, you know, that's why I chose to be an illustrator. That was because I loved fantasy books and I really wanted to be, you know, to be true to the books I was loving. So that's exactly what I'm trying to do with The Song of Ice and Fire, for example, because the books are wonderful and the books need to be respected, and I'm trying to be at least respectful. I do not say that my own vision will be, you know, the one vision. It's not possible at all. But I'm trying to show how much I admire this book. And
I'm also a book purist, so I definitely appreciate that. And I've noticed that, I don't know what your comments on this might be, but that the TV show doesn't really influence your work as much. Mm-hmm. And I respect that.
You know, that's mainly because I started working on Game of Thrones long before the TV show was released. And so, first of all, I always have, at least very often have this answer from people, is it hard to not to be influenced by the TV show?
Ha, that was my next question.
that's not hard at all because I am only working with the books. I do watch the TV show and I love it, by the way, but I'm really aware that what I see is not what is written. So I'm really doing everything I can not to, you know, to forget everything about the actors and all. But sometimes it's complicated. The best example of it is Khal Drogo, mm-hmm. because he is what he is. I mean, he's described as he is in the TV show. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to make something different. And when I painted him the first time for FFG, it was also long before the TV show. But lots of people told me, yeah, you painted the actor from the show. And no, I didn't. I was there first. But now it's, the TV show is so huge that a lot of people think the books didn't exist before.
Now, you mentioned that you try and bring your vision of what is described to the work. I wonder how that changes when you get to work more directly with the author, as you presumably did with The World of Ice and Fire.
Yeah.
And when you're starting to bring his vision rather than necessarily what he wrote. I don't know. How was that different?
It was not that different because George Martin is not very hard to please, as long as he can see that you did read the book. That's something he wants you to read the books. And I understand that. As long as you are paying attention to the little details, descriptions and all, he is happy with that. But there are a few exceptions. Once I really had a hard time with one character. It was for Tyrion Lannister. I painted him for the calendar I made for this year. And there is a piece showing the Battle of Blackwater. That was a very tough one because George Martin himself told me that, it was not him directly, it was his assistant. How do you say that?
Yeah, his assistant, Ty, I believe.
Yeah, that most of the time, Tyrion was not looking like he should look. And they told me, obviously, in the TV show, he doesn't look like he should. And so they really wanted me to try to make, as close a vision to the book as possible. But that implied making lots of researches about dwarves and how they look and how they were, their head structure and, arms and legs. And so the first sketch I made, they told me, no, he's way too handsome. he had to look like a little monster. That's really what they wanted. And I always have, maybe if you know most of my work, you know that I'm better at pretty things. So it was very hard for me to paint him because he had to look, he had to look like a hero, but not looking good. So that was kind of a challenge. And George Martin really, really asked for more and more revisions until we got to a point when he really thought that it was a pretty close vision to what he wanted. And I was really something interesting because Tyrion is such an important character so many people love, and it was kind of a responsibility with this character. So I really, once again, did my best to please the author first, which meant that if he was happy, maybe the people who would see the image would be too and have, a new vision of this character who's not always looking the way the author wants him to look. So I hope I did something good.
That's the one with him in the sort of golden armor with the axe and some of the wildfire in the background? Is that the one guy? Yes.
Yes, yes. It's mainly shades of green and all.
So actually that leads in very nicely to another thing. So you've done work on calendars. You said you started in book covers. How are those different from cards in the way you approach them?
Mm-hmm. The main difference is that for book covers, you have to, a book cover doesn't have to be as precise as a card illustration is going to be. When you paint a cover, you have to give a very rough idea of the whole thing. When it's a card, you have to paint one very specific moment. That's the difference. On a book cover, it's not always a good idea to paint a very specific scene from the book, because it's hard to sum up a whole book in only one image. So you have to try to make an image that's gonna feel like the whole text. I don't know if I'm making myself clear.
No, I understand.
But when it's about a card, especially when you're working for universes such as The Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones, based on existing books with, you know, very famous scenes, and for cards, you really have to make very precise things. You can be too generic, you know. That's the main difference. It's a very, you know, a very subtle one, but it's a major difference.
So you seem to have an excellent memory for all of these projects that you've worked on and the specific cards. I wonder if there are any in particular that went into the card game. You mentioned His Viper Eyes at the beginning as being one of your starting points. Are there ones that really stand out as your favorites, or as the ones where you really felt particularly proud of these Game of Thrones cards?
Yeah, I do have lots of memories for these cards, because they are all kind of, you know, steps in my career. I remember, for example, when I was assigned to the Jaime Lannister piece, I think it was this one. It was my very first hero card, and it was Jaime Lannister, and I love this character. I was over the moon. I can't explain. Because before him, I had painted Daenerys, you know, just before she is killing her husband.
The one with the pillow.
Yeah, exactly.
Ah, yes. I quite a powerful scene. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was, you know, it was not quite like painting the, you know, the Jaime Lannister card.
Mm-hmm.
When I was assigned to this one, I said, okay, you have to give everything you have on this one. And I loved working on that. When I'm looking at it now, I'm a bit ashamed. I wish I could paint him again, because it's getting old, you know. But that one is a very good memory. Another good memory I have is when I was assigned the other Daenerys Targaryen with her dragons, you know, the special one with a full frame card.
The one where she's walking on fire and has the three dragons present.
Yeah, it's that one.
I am one of the very lucky players to have that. So as part of the World Championship, winning that, I have that on a big playmat. As the only one in the world. And it is gorgeous. It is fantastic.
That's so cool. I didn't know playmat existed. You lucky one.
I feel lucky. But if you ask it of me, I will send it to you.
No, that's okay. It's yours. But yeah, this illustration, I spent a lot of time on this one, because I really wanted to. Because at that point, my skills had evolved. I think it's pretty obvious between the first Daenerys and this one, there is a huge gap as far as the pure technique is concerned. And so this one, you know, in general, when I'm painting a piece, it takes me about 30 to 35 hours of painting, not including the sketching phase. But for Daenerys one, I think I was close to the 45, 50 hours of painting, because I wanted to pay so much attention to detail, the costume, the atmosphere, the expression and all that. That was a very important one for me. And it was even more important when one day I received an email from my art director, who was forwarding an email from George Martin about this piece, because when it's about main characters in the series, he really wants to approve their look. He wants to see, he doesn't see all the cards FFG make, but main characters he wants to see. So obviously he saw the Daenerys. And I remember I received his original email, which was a very short one, saying, "Whoa," in capital letters. And that's what I still have this message. And,
excellent.
And I was so proud of it, so proud of it. And even now, this piece is a few years old, but I'm still very proud and very attached to that one.
If it's the one I think it is, you mentioned previously that you don't do creatures very often.
Mm-hmm.
But in this piece, there's the dragons, right?
Yes.
With the
mm-hmm.
You can see through the sort of the sinew of their wings, the light coming through and sort of the individual veins.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think you can say you don't do creatures anymore, because you did a superb job. It's really, the detail is fantastic on the...
That's very kind of you, and I'm happy that you do like them, but you really, believe me, it was such a fight between me and them, trying to mend, because in general, when I'm painting creatures, they tend to look cute, but not really impressive. And it's always a challenge for me trying to make them look, you know, I'm a creature, I'm not something cuddly or cute and all. So, and dragons are really not my, you know, my main talent. I tried my best once again, but it also explains why it took me so long on this piece, because three dragons. Can you imagine how afraid I was?
Well, dragons are supposed to inspire fear. Maybe not in the artist, but that's okay too.
It also works for the artist, believe me.
Now, I was, you touched on this earlier, and you mentioned that you have a sort of reduced involvement in the Game of Thrones card game,
mm-hmm.
and that you still occasionally get called upon to do something for Fantasy Flight. I'm assuming that this has mostly a lot to do with an increased involvement with magic. Is that about right?
Yes, absolutely.
So how has that transition been? Because that's a world where you don't... I guess you're much freer to draw things where people don't have previous expectations, right? They don't have the book where they know exactly what this new avatar or character or planeswalker should look like. How does that change your process as an artist?
It's not that different, because even if it's not based on a book or anything like that, it's based on magic's own history. Mm-hmm. So we always receive style guides. It's kind of pretty big booklets with lots of illustrations, lots of references for us. And we always have to start from something that already exists. It's not pure creation, even when you're creating something new. For magic, for example, I created a new planeswalker, but this planeswalker was still based on something that was already decided by them, you know, at first. But, you know, that's something different with magic, that you are creating something new, even though it's based on something that already exists. What they are telling us is that, okay, here you have references, but do not take it as something literal. Just take a look at it and then try to go further and make it progress. That's how their universe is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, because they are counting on each of us to give a little something more to what's already been done in the game. That's different, but it's not creating from scratch either.
Well, the last little one I wanted to ask is, I really do want to find out what it would take to get to see more of your art in Thrones, but I think that wouldn't be a fair question. But I'm wondering, is there a Game of Thrones character that you haven't done, you really want to do, and I can start yelling at Fantasy Flight Games to get you to do that character or that moment that you would really like to do?
There is one character I really do love. It's a, well, pronunciation, Jorah Mormont.
Jorah Mormont, yes.
Yeah. I love this character, and I never painted him. I'd really love to.
Well, I will make sure to yell at Fantasy Flight Games. I'm convinced them. People would love to see a new version of Jorah. Mm. Both in the game, he's a very popular character. And
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. There's a version of him in the core set that sees a lot of play. And, you know, frequently they will release new versions. And for the new version to be popular, it also has to be at least as good as the old version. So it would be a very good card.
Yeah.
I think if you're given a choice between playing a card that has Magali art or playing another card, you play the card with the Magali art, of course.
Oh, that I think that deserves a hug, you know.
I left France 3 days ago. I'll have to return.
but I have one question for you both. Besides, I know that when you're working for Magic the Gathering, I learned that's something I really didn't know, that the illustration doesn't matter that much. If you want players to really love your illustration, you have to make sure that it's going to be for a very powerful card. You know, you can make a wonderful illustration and spend hours working on it. If the final card is not a good one, no one's going to pay attention. Do you think it's different for FFG's game cards? How important illustrations are for you?
I'll answer my opinion, and then Alex, you're free to follow up. But I think it depends. For example, in the first edition, there was three versions of the Red Viper.
Mm-hmm.
One that was incredibly overpowered and overplayed, and then another one that was powerful but not as good with your artwork. And I know personally of many people who played your version over the overpowered version, partially due to your artwork. But I do think that when you get to a competition, most players will pick the more powerful card.
Cool.
and then later make their own alternate art cards that use the better art on the other card. I think I've seen a little bit of that as well.
Yeah, but there is some kind of an expectation as far as a character's rendition is going to be, right?
Yeah, I could see that for a sort of like a big pivotal character to have the best art. Or
there are a couple of things that make it different from Magic. First of all, there's a lot less money involved.
Yes.
You win a tournament, there's mm-hmm. there's no money in that. So people do take a slightly more relaxed approach to that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Also, because it's a living card game where the distribution is not random like in Magic, you mm-hmm. The difference between one card and another doesn't have to be quite as big. In Magic, they have to make rares, you know, more impactful or more powerful in some way, you know, the flashy cards rather than the sort of necessary cards.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you get Magali to do the rare cards, well, it'll probably be more exciting, I imagine. But I think the last one is that there's a subset of players that are called medley players, referring to Eddard Stark, which play the game to recreate moments from, not specifically, but to try and create a deck that depicts, you know, House Stark at this moment in time. And they won't put, you know, a Lannister card in there because that would be wrong, even if the game allows for it.
Interesting.
And these are called Nedley players.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of players, you know, they really appreciate it when they have Bran and Hodor on playing at the same time and that kind of thing. And those ones will definitely be heavily influenced by the art in that they're really trying to create a deck that depicts an experience that ties it into the books. And they're typically players who read the books and then came to the game and really feel like they should try and create even the gameplay to reflect how the books play out.
That's very interesting. And I guess that's what makes the FFG's games very unique because, it's a different experience from other card games, I guess.
And I mean, we do card reviews on the podcast, and it's true that we will often say, well, this is, you know, absolutely amazing art, really, really nice. Unfortunately, it's never going to go into one of my decks.
Yeah.
And so we do that sometimes. I don't want to claim that it's not the case. You know, we almost always talk about the art, but it's, you know, sometimes with the statement that we know that unfortunately this card just doesn't work mechanically, despite the fact that it's fantastic. Which must be frustrating for the artist.
It's not. I would say that from my experience, it's not as frustrating as it sometimes is with magic. Especially, well, now it's improving because I am making, as time goes by, I'm lucky enough to be assigned to more powerful and important cards, showing planeswalkers and all. Mm-hmm. But when you're starting, of course, they cannot just give you rare cards like that. They have to test you. They have to know what you're worth, you know. And I remember I was kind of disappointed because they put such lots of efforts in this one. And nobody cares. It's, you know, it was not that, you know, obvious with FFG. Because
I think there's also the fact that, you know, with Magic, you open a booster and there's a random set of cards, mm-hmm. and you don't want someone to look at your card and go, crap, I got this card that I didn't want.
Yeah.
In Game of Thrones, you open a pack, it's got the same 20 cards for everybody, and you get to appreciate those cards independently of their rarity or what they're mm-hmm. replacing. I think that probably helps a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. You're just not hunting the big ones, so. Mm-hmm. You have everything, so.
Mm. And to have a valuation placed on a card outside of your control. So this card is worth 50 cents
mm-hmm.
after 50 hours working on the art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that would be frustrating. Yes, yeah, that's something we have to learn to live with. That's the way.
That doesn't sound easy. It doesn't sound easy.
Well, us artists do not have the same point of view. Our point of view is all about art. As far as I'm concerned, I can tell you that I do not know how to play, whether it is Game of Thrones or Lord of the Rings or Magic. I really do not know how to play this game. So I know kind of nothing about them. You know, some players tried, you know, to teach me how to play. They really tried very hard. It was always to no avail. I'm hopeless. I'm really hopeless. So, of course, my interest is all about art, and I want people to see my illustrations and to like them. But I understand that it's only my point of view. Now I understand. It took me some time, but now it's okay.
I think Sean mentioned a good point, though. You'll frequently see within Game of Thrones where people will create their own custom card, mm-hmm. and they'll completely illegally and without asking anyone for the permission, yeah. but mm-hmm. they'll take the art from the card that they really like and put it on the card they like to use. Mm-hmm. So if there are two versions of the Red Viper, as you said, I frequently saw people within non-tournament settings playing a version that had the text from one and then had your artwork because mm-hmm. they appreciated that aspect of the card.
You know that this one, the Red Viper illustration, was probably maybe the one players seem to like, you know, very much because each time I, you know, repost it on my Facebook and all, it's always, wow. Best Red Viper ever. I'm very proud about that one. And I really also have good memories of this one because it's one of, you know, one of these illustrations when everything goes so smoothly from sketch to color. You know, no revision, everyone very happy about it at FFG. Yeah, it was, once again, I love this character. So I guess that it does help when you're painting a character you really like. It really does help you making a better illustrations.
Excellent. Well, given how much you mentioned you love Jorah, I'm sure we'll look forward to very shortly. You'll get some email from Fantasy Flight, and we'll get to see a Jorah you love as well. That's my hope.
If that happens, I will know who I have to thank, you know, for this.
So. All right, I can make this happen. They owe me a few favors.
Really? That's interesting.
So I will do my best in that regard.
Okay.
I was wondering one more thing. So you have attended Stalic before, which is a little harder for North Americans to attend. Yeah. Did you have any plans to come to Gen Con in Indianapolis, or FFG has their own Worlds event? Is there any North American conventions on your in your schedule?
That's not, you know, something big for them, having artists signing cards and something like that. So really, I never had the occasion. The one time I could sign for, you know, FFG American players was last year. I was in the U.S. for the San Diego Grand Prix for Magic. And then I spent about 10 days in Minnesota, and I visited the FFG headquarters, and they organized kind of a, you know, little signatory thing so a few players could have their cards signed. That was wonderful, but it was so such a tiny thing. I wish I could. I really wish I could, you know, attend to a Gen Con, something like that. Maybe it will happen, but it's not, you know, nothing right now.
So that's another thing I have to add on my list of things to write to Fantasy Flight Games about.
I think you have to make a choice. What's more important for you, the new card or designing Evan? Because
Well, which one would you prefer? Because one, you get to draw a Jorah. The other one, you get to go to Minnesota in November when it's already minus 10 degrees Celsius. I mean, I don't know which one you'd hate me more.
I don't know if I'm ready for that.
It's not Bordeaux either, yeah.
No, not really.
All right. Well, thank you, Magali, so much for joining us, especially, you know, staying up late so that we could arrange this time schedule-wise. I'm extremely glad to hear from you. You may not know how much of a role you've had in shaping the game, even beyond your involvement. Lord of the Rings, there's so many artists that have followed in your style and in your footsteps by inspiration that I would say that you have defined the art style for that game, which I love. And then for Game of Thrones, you know, it's in its second edition. The style is changing a little, but there's still a home for Magali art. And I'm so glad to have had you on the cast.
That's wonderful to hear, because I worked for so long and so hard for these games that if I could at least, you know, leave a good memory, that's wonderful.
More than a memory. It's a legacy. I would say it's a legacy.
Thank you so much.
Closing comments. I have a list of regionals. We will fire them off really, really quickly because, actually, those are the ones for this week. So that's not even going to help. They're the ones that are happening right now. I have another list of regionals, an accurate list of regionals. We'll go through them very quickly, and then we're going to talk a little bit about when we'll have a next episode. So the regionals coming up this next weekend. France, there's one in Nantes on the 11th of June. There's Montclair, California on the 11th of June. Nashua, New Hampshire on the 11th of June. Tulsa in Oklahoma, 11th of June. Vancouver, Washington, 11th of June. Prague in the Czech Republic on the 11th of June. And it's just a little bit further off. We have the U.S. Nationals in Columbus, Ohio on the 15th to the 19th. And the Milano Fighting Pits, the Road to Stalic Italian leg on the 18th and 19th. So basically running into that next weekend, but worth mentioning this week.
I have a little bit before we talk about when we're going to get another cast up. I want to do a shout out to your contribution, which is Dennis's channel. It's actually had some great content lately, and it's been produced by two people from Florida. Lauren and her husband have been producing some really, really great content. I think they've been doing commentation, and I actually watched their first two videos, and it was impressive.
All right.
They also have great karaoke skills.
Yes, there's that as well.
It's an important Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I just thought I'd put it in there. That's why I'm here, to bring you the important side of Thrones.
So lastly, I think as part of closing comments, we're still looking at an every 2 week schedule until we get our shit together. And our shit is not currently together, as I'm sure you've all figured out from the last months.
Yep. Every 2 weeks, no shit together.
So we're still trying to get our shit together. We are working towards getting our shit together. Currently, our shit is all over the place. Once our shit is together, we will inform you. But in the meantime, I will still be posting an article on the off weeks, to do a little summary of the news and stuff, so we're caught up on that. But the episodes will be every 2 weeks until shit has been got together.
Could be a while.
That's a better way to say that. Yeah.
Alex, you have another baby coming.
Clearly, we need more fiber in our diets. All right.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.